From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. We know Paul Feig, my guest who's brushing off the table across from me, as the author of Superstar.
And a famous neatnik.
And a famous neatnik, and of course a film director. He's been here for several of his films, and the creator of, what was that show again, Paul?
Freaks and Greeks, was it? I think. I don't know.
I thought it was Feeks and Greeks, but that's okay.
We tried.
We'll Greek now. We also know him as, for my money, the most stylish man in film. And I'm sure he'll be back for his new film, which is, what's your new film?
It's called A Simple Favor with Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively. Super fun thriller, but not till next year, Elvis.
So we'll have to set off with talking to Paul about the thing that I talk to him the most often about when we're not on the show, which is fashion. Okay. And you recently collaborated with J. Crew.
Yes.
Tell us about the collaboration.
It was really exciting for me. I've always wanted to have a line of suiting and men's fashion because I'm really into men's styling. And I infamously, I guess among some people, wear a suit and tie every single day when I'm on set directing, when I'm in the editing room, when I'm in meetings, obviously. But yeah, and so I've just always had an interest in it, and I have a very specific style that I like, which is sort of, I'd say, Savile Row British tailoring meets like an Italian sprezzatura sort of feel to it, and thought I've just always wanted to be able to design my own suits and have them out. And basically contacted J. Crew. We contacted a few places, and everybody's like, well, who cares about you? You're a 55-year-old director. Nobody knows who a director is, what we do. But fortunately, J. Crew said, yeah, we'd like to. They'd had a successful collaboration with Jimmy Fallon for these iPhone cases that had like a pocket square on top. So you could put it in your breast pocket and it looked like you had a pocket square in, which was very clever. And so we said, yeah, we'll do it for charity and let's you know, put something out. And it was just originally going to be like pocket silks, because I like designing little patterns and then having artists elaborate on them. But then it slowly morphed into, well, we'll do a jacket, we'll do some shirts, well, we'll do a full suit, we'll do cufflinks, and we'll do boutonnieres and all this. And suddenly we had this like nice mini line, the Paul Feig for J. Crew line. There's a label that says that, so you can, I have a label. I finally have a label that's not derogatory.
Well, somebody who sticks to the Lee Majors line for Sears, I find that.
I was always inspired by when, remember Johnny Carson had his line for Sears?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's funny is you remind me, because one of the things that I'm always sort of struck by is that you have an eye for drama in terms of the way you dress.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a theatricality in the way you dress, but not melodramatic.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, thank you. That's a kind of an interesting way to put it, because here's the thing. When I was a kid, I used to get really jealous because women had so many different options of what they could wear. There was just a million different styles when you're dressing up. And guys, it was always like, well, it's a suit, you know, suit and a tie, suit and a tie. And so I always kind of felt like, oh, how can you, because I love suits and I like the way that guys look in suits, but it's like, how can we then give it its own personality and realize, oh, it's through the tie, it's through pocket silks. And then when I went to Paris and went to Charvet, they'd sell these boutonnieres, these kind of, you know, silk flowers.
Yes.
Yeah, that you put in. I was like, oh, cool. So these are ways to pop it. And then obviously we had cufflinks that we could kind of play with. And then beyond that, it's just what patterns you want to do with your suits. And, you know, I just like to dress them up that way. So you know what? It's a way of telling people I'm wearing a suit, but I'm not that serious about it.
But the thing, though, I kind of wonder about, because we're both, not only we're both Midwesterners, we're both from the same city.
Mm-hmm.
You're from
good old Detroit.
Well,
I know.
Detroit.
Yeah, right.
As many white people, you're not from
Detroit.
Right.
Detroit is a concept. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, like Hollywood. But there was, in Detroit, there were places you went to shop if you had a flair for shopping. I wonder where you shopped in Detroit as a kid, as a teenager growing up.
I'll tell you exactly where I shopped. There was a store at the Lakeside Mall called Silverman's. I remember that. And this was, but this was disco era stuff.
Oh,
this
I remember, yes. This would be the introduction of the members only jacket.
Yeah, yes, yes. I remember when that came in and it was like, oh, this is going to catch on. And it's never let go for men of a certain age. You still see those members only jackets floating around. And I know those guys are going, hey, this is my new jacket that I got 30 years ago.
But there were lots of jackets there, though.
It was, yeah.
Because it had lots of blazers, actually.
It was the disco era. So, you know, we were dressing up. I was, you know, I was in my junior and senior in high school when that was going on. And it was very jacket and dress pants and, you know, nice shirt based. I mean, they were all polyester. And the shirts especially were those crazy faux silk numbers.
The Nick Nick Kiana.
Yes.
See, <it's, laughs>
well done with Angel's Flight pants on the bottom, and oh, it's a walk down memory lane. But we look good. We thought we looked good.
Yes, we did.
But it was
in
that.
Fact, that's what you're wearing. You're wearing a similar outfit on the cover of Superstud.
Yes, yes. My book, Superstud, ironically titled. But that was actually a disco suit I had that then we turned into because I was in a dance recital because I took tap dancing for 8 years.
I'm sorry, you tap danced in that suit?
Yes, I did. I did with that spicy lime green giant bow tie. A terrible, let it not be thought that I was a good tap dancer either. I was the worst. I was taught at a school in Sterling Heights, I think it was, and 8 years, and I was never taught a time step. Never once taught how to do a time step. All our tap dancing was jazz and taps, so it was a lot of flat ball change. And me looking terrible.
It's the treatment, my guess, who the entire film over has been now explained by the fact he never learned to do a time step is Paul Feig. Again, we know him as the author of Superstud and of many great films. But you're talking about his line of clothes for J. Crew. But that theatricality, I wonder, because that disco era, actually, one of the great things about it is it called for a certain kind of peacockery. You know,
yes.
There was, if you had an eye, you could put together a look. And one of the things I think that still stuck with is the thing I love most about disco and actually looking at your jacket, thinking about it, and it's, the designer once told me it's a really peacockish thing at the peak lapel.
Yeah.
Because that was a big thing during the
disco. It was all about the peak lapel, yeah. Because it was all about kind of taking up as much room as you could with things. That's why the giant lapels and the giant bell bottoms and the giant ties and huge collars. It was really, it's sort of the golf of fashion, I guess. You know, like a lot and taking up a lot of room for no real reason. I did love the peacockery of it all. I mean, but it got crazy in the 70s. I mean, with the leisure suits, we have home movies of my father in Trafalgar Square in 1976, walking among all these really conservatively dressed men in suits in a yellow leisure suit, wearing a straw hat with a big orange, white, and white polka dot
band
on it. Yeah. And just, it's horrifying. And yet, I remember thinking, hey, that's pretty cool.
So is your father Walter Murphy? I mean,
pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. The bowler crowd didn't approve.
But going to the UK for the first time like that and seeing what people were wearing, was that a real impact on you, didn't it?
Yeah, it was, because I also love that real formal British thing. You know, and I was also like a big Monty Python fan, so I thought, like, guys in really conservative suits, that's really funny, because, you know, when Cleese is doing the silly walk, and he's dressed completely straight as a banker, I go, that's actually kind of funny, too. And I love the idea of anarchy in a suit. But I also think in order to not, unless you're going to do a silly walk or be crazy, when you're walking down the street, you also don't want people to go like, oh, look, there's some Wall Street guy who's, you know, mean. Not that bad to be a Wall Street guy, but I don't want to be boring. But so when you put on something colorful with it or put in some bit of sprezzatura, which is the Italian term for just having something amiss, then it just tells people, okay, he's not that serious about it, but he wants to look good at the same time. Or at least that's what I hope they take away from when I walk down the street.
Because we're roughly the same age, and I think one of the things I end up thinking about too, and I'm sure this is an impact on both your decision about comedy and style with Steve Martin.
Yeah, very much so. Huge. Yeah, because he was the first guy doing stand-up in the white suit, the white three-piece suit with the black tie, you know, and I had all his posters up. I had the Best Fishes poster, which was the famous one of him standing there in the suit, but he had a rubber fish sticking out. And that really kind of cemented it for me. I mean, honestly, the beginning of it started with my obsession with suiting. I used to watch old movies with my mom, you know, like Cary Grant and...
Probably on Bill Kennedy Presents.
Yes, on Bill Kennedy, yes. It was the voice of Superman. It's a Faster Than the Speeding Bullet. Yeah, that was him. This is some real deep
I know.
Detroit trivia for you all.
Let me say hi to our listeners.
I was going to say, like, is anybody listening right now? I think they've all turned off.
A question I've asked myself every week, but that has nothing to do with
it. I always listen, Elvis. I always listen. But yeah, but he was doing these crazy things with the arrow through his head and playing banjo, but he had the suit on, and he looked, I remember thinking, he looks really good, but he's being funny. And that was such a big takeaway for me. And I was such a Steve Martin fanatic that I actually went out and bought a 3-piece white suit and would wear it every night in my room. I bought a mic stand and a cheap microphone at Radio Shack and would put on Let's Get Small, his first album, and lip sync to it every night by myself. In my room.
Please tell me there's a photograph of this somewhere.
There is a photograph of me in my room with a banjo. I started to play the banjo because of Steve. I just wanted to be Steve Martin.
But also, just watching so much of yourself, thinking about those contradictions of awareness versus non-awareness is a big part of the way you think is in terms of comedy, too, is it not?
Very much so. Very much. Yeah, I love polar opposites, you know, just like how I love guys in suits being funny. I like the settings to be places where you wouldn't think something funny would happen, or, you know, look, I love the Marx Brothers was always great. You know, nothing's better than that. Or like the Three Stooges, they come into like a fancy party and here come these guys and you go like, okay, something terrible is going to happen. What I love about Groucho is that he was always, you know, he had a style.
Yeah, but morning coat.
Totally. And that was, which was great, which was a real formal thing. And then here's this guy creating complete anarchy. There's something just so wonderful about that, because that's stuff we don't get to do in real life. And look, if I'm in a really nice setting in real life and some guy walked in and tore the place apart, I would be horrified and I wouldn't be happy about it. But that's what we love about movies. That's why we like horror movies, because you can be pushed to the edge and put in danger. And yet you're not, because you're sitting in a safe place. And with comedy, it's nice to be sitting there going like, oh gosh, if that really happened when I was there, I would be so embarrassed, but I can really just let it all out laughing at that, because it's not me and I'm watching what is clearly a controlled situation that was created by the filmmaker. And I think that's just that is so cathartic for an audience and for me, you know, as an audience member, that it's fun to recreate that.
In addition to those contrasts, but again, for me, the crux is the aware versus the not aware.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one person is completely aware of everything going on around
her.
So, which is an interesting thing too, because that's a state that women exist in.
Yeah.
They have to be hyper aware in the way that men often don't.
Yeah, you know, but that's why I love doing female based comedy and movies in general, just because I like the take that women have on the world a little bit more. I think the guy take is sort of can be kind of aggressive, or just sort of seeing things, I don't know, a little more, I don't know, I don't want to get in trouble for talking about how men see the world, but I think the way that women see the world is more detailed, and it is more about sort of what is happening in decorum and kind of more aware sometimes of appearances in a way that the guys judge it differently.
Because women so often have to be aware of the effect they have when they walk into a room.
Right, exactly. And so it's really fun to play with that. I mean, in Bridesmaids, it was so much fun to play with that. Just what I loved was, you know, we had Rose Byrne playing Helen, who was this, you know, rich woman who was trying to steal away Kristen's friend, you know, played by Maya Rudolph. And so we always wanted to have like a really good introduction to Rose. And we wrote all this stuff where she's kind of being mean, offhandedly mean to Kristen's character, and then, you know, move on from there. But I wanted to put her in this giant dress, which a lot of people on the movie were like, that dress is too ridiculous. I said, no, this is the kind of person she'd be in this giant dress. And so she turned around in that dress, and people just immediately laugh. And then she comes up, and every time we did the scene and cut a version of the scene where she was being kind of mean to Kristen, it just was too much. You didn't need it. And so we just ended up taking all the jokes out and just making her very pleasant. And people just hated her guts because, you know, and I think a lot of women were just able to go like, oh, we know that woman. We've seen her that overdresses for these things. It's so perfect and kind of in control of the situation. And then it made it more fun to see their toast battle that they did after that, because you didn't realize that she was against her.
We're going to take a break. My guest, who is a beautiful portrait in contrast, is physically, literally is Paul Feig. He's a director, author, and now fashion designer. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. I'm talking to director, author, and fashion designer. I just like saying that, Paul Feig. It's the treatment. It's interesting now because we also live in a time where there's so many collaborations, where you have so many people doing things with sneaker lines or with clothing lines. But the point of this has to be for you to invest this stuff with enough of your personality that people know it's you. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what that those conversations were like. What was it that you went in armed with saying, I'm going to say to J. Crew that these things are important for me to have in these pieces, and what were their responses?
Well, it just really, I've gotten press over the years just being one of the few directors in Hollywood who dresses up. I mean, there are other guys like Chris Nolan and, you know, Wes Anderson, and there's other guys who do it too. But I think I'm sort of the more peacocky of the group, because it was a very conscious decision I made when I decided I was going to start wearing a suit for directing. Because I remember, you know, the first thing I really directed.
As I said to you when you first came, I remember when you wore t-shirts and jeans when I first met you.
Well, yeah, because that was when I was doing Freaks and Geeks, and that was all about, I'm going to reconnect with sort of like a high school vibe, which is ridiculous. It's like, man, in his late 30s at that point. But yeah, I grew my hair long. I looked, you know, it was crazy. But then coming out of that, I remember thinking, you know, when I went into directing and I decided behind the scenes, when I was taking meetings, I was going to start wearing suits again. But then when I was going to direct, it was like, well, I can't wear a suit because I, you know, you're working. And I thought, well, why not? My dad used to wear a suit at work all the time. And he worked in, you know, an army surplus store in Detroit and worked in the warehouse pulling down boxes. And he always, you know, looked good. It was a cheap suit, but he wore it. And so I kind of eased into it by wearing a suit, but no tie. And then it kind of, I was like, oh, this is cool. And people kind of liked it. And so then I was like, well, I can wear a tie. And then slowly it was just like, why don't I just wear the full the full crazy thing with, you know, with boutonnieres and pocket silks and just go for it, because I'm not rolling around on the ground as a director. Occasionally I have to kind of get down on my knees to line up a shot. But, you know, that's the nice thing about being a director. Just everybody else does stuff. You sit there and bark out orders in a friendly way. But any, get back to your question. So I kind of, that had, you know, gotten out into the press, and I, you know, had Esquire had called me the best dressed man in Hollywood a couple of years back. And so it was just kind of like, look, we can capitalize on that. This is not a giant line where we're going to take over J. Crew. It's like, let's do like a limited line for charity. And 50% of the proceeds from these pocket silks that we did go to benefit Stomp Out Bullying, which is a great anti-bullying organization. But it, you know, it was just like a way to go like, look, let's capitalize on this thing that I have for some people. And again, if we're trying to shoot wide, is, you know, it's like when Michael Kors does something with Target or whatever. You know, I think that's great. That really that sells out really fast. What I loved about doing it with J. Crew is so many guys use the excuse of, I can't dress up because it's too expensive or blah, blah, blah. So it's like, well, let's put out really cool suits that are more affordable. And so that's what I love about a J. Crew for doing that. And you know, these, you know, a full 3-piece suit out of my collection, and you can buy the pieces separately, all in is, you know, a little over $800.
I look at this, and this, I know you socially for a while, this is the kind of thing I would associate with you. I mean, this looks like a Paul Feig suit to me. Well, and I know you're very specific about the kinds of things you pick. I mean, look at the fabric and the tie, which looks like it's not the kind of thing I would normally associate with J. Crew.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all about color and just kind of making an impression. And I like suits with patterns in them. And, you know, this is kind of a, you know, like a almost houndstooth check kind of item. And one of the other suits is just a kind of a nice lighter blue suit, because I don't like suits that are so crazy that people know, see you in that suit and they know every time you wear it, versus if you have something that's has some personality, but it's not so out there that then using a different tie, using different pocket silk, people go like, oh, is that a different suit? And they're like, you know, you can admit if it is or not. But so I do lean towards, you know, if I'm advising somebody to put their closet together, a guy, say, first get like a couple of just normal pattern suits. Get like, you know, your standard kind of navy suit, and, you know, maybe something with just like a nice check pattern in it or a window pane, but nothing too crazy color wise, because then you can do that. Then you can get a lot of life out of those suits by mixing up, you get a bunch of ties and that, and then have fun with those. And then, but then as you go forward, find the patterns that speak to you and kind of, again, tell the world who you are. When I see suits that just have a pattern I didn't expect, I think it's really fun, but I never get something that's so out there and nuts that it's, you know, it's going to go in and out of style too fast. I love like just never in style, never out of style, just classic tailoring.
What was the first great suit you bought? You must remember this. The first thing you really spent money on.
Well, I do. I mean, I didn't buy it. My mother bought it for me, which was when I was about 8 or 9, and I read this Groucho Marx biography that said he never trusted a man who didn't wear a suit or didn't dress well. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I have to do that. And my mother, I was an only child, so I was like little Lord Fauntleroy. So she immediately, you know, I said, I want to get a suit. And she's like, cool. So we went off to the Somerset Mall, which was the fancy mall, if you know. You know that. And found a Pierre Cardin three-piece suit that was absolutely gorgeous.
Was that box notch cut?
Yeah.
The lapel?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was a beautiful suit, but I was 9 years old, and it fit me beautifully. And I wore it for probably 3 months before I grew out of it. My father was very upset when we came home. He's like, oh, my God, he's going to grow out of that thing in 3 months. And he was right, but oh, what a 3 months they were. I looked like the world's most alive ventriloquist dummy walking around in that thing.
But it's interesting because there's so much about clashing and or taking things that – because there was a point where if you wore this many patterns, people would say you were taking too many chances.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And but that's obviously something you've always gravitated towards, that idea of 9-year-old wearing a suit, that idea of pushing boundaries goes back really far for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always just thought, take a chance because, you know, everything that's good that's happened to me in my career and in my life has been the moments where I go like, you know what? Screw this. I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to do it. You know, it started when I was like a kid, like the thing that seduced me into comedy more than anything was I was in second grade and the choir, we were doing some, you know, a recital in front of the whole school, and we're singing Yellow Bird, the Calypso hit. And so they said, oh, we should have a little Calypso band to be next to them while they sing it. And so they gave us instruments, and they gave me this conga drum, like Ricky Ricardo. And I'm in this dumb hat and stupid like costume. And so they start doing it, and I start kind of playing the conga, but I'm kind of get into it, and I'm sort of like swaying around in this really kind of weird way. And I hear the people start laughing. And so I'm like, oh. So I start going for it more and getting goofier and really like going for it on this drum. And the laughs are getting bigger and bigger. And then I just go complete ham and I'm like dancing around with this thing. And they're going nuts. And that was the moment I go like, well, God, this is – you know, if I would have held back and just been like a normal conga guy, then it would just have been like, okay, we were listening to Yellow Bird and a lovely song, but not that interesting. And here, suddenly, by kind of taking this chance and going for it in this ridiculous outfit on top of it, it was fun, and I made people happy. I mean, I went back to my class, and I was in love with my teacher at the time, Miss Hill, I think her name was. And one of my friends goes like, Miss Hill was crying. She was laughing so hard at what you were doing. And it's like, oh, my gosh, well, this is great. Like, everything I ever wanted as a second grader, I got out of just going for it and not being afraid to look ridiculous.
But also, and clearly, an early awareness of the adult world.
Yeah.
Is part of what your makeup too, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was really. It's funny. Like my cousin always said, like, so why do you hate kids? Because like whenever we'd be watching a TV show, I always like the adults on the show, and then we'd be like a wisecracking kid, and I was like, oh, I hate that kid. Like it never made me happy, just because I didn't want to see somebody my age sort of ruling over the adults.
No kidding.
Yeah, I just always found it really annoying because I liked all my friends, but I didn't feel like any of us were so like, you know, cool and superior that we could kind of like really get one over on the adults around us. And I just loved the comedy of adults so much. But it did come from things like Monty Python, where the adults are all crazy, but then you'd watch, you know, Bewitched and all these things, and you go like, the adults are really funny. And I always was like kind of sided with the adult world. And then when I was little, probably like 5 or 6, my parents went to Vegas for one of the big fights, when they used to do the big fights there, and took me. And I remember, you know, in the old days of Vegas, we come into, I forget which one it was, the Sands maybe or something, and you walk in, but the kids weren't even allowed to, like, look at the casino floor. So they brought me in, and we're kind of walking around the upper level, and you're looking down the casino floor. So I'm, like, looking at it, and there's all these people dressed up nice, and it's, like, you know, adults and all this things going on.
So it's like that, so the end of Vegas glamour.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, people were still, my memory was a lot of people were in tuxedos and suits and women in beautiful dresses. And they took me past that and then put me in this nursery that was very cruelly. It had this like sliding glass window that then looked out like onto the casino. And so there I was stuck in this like stupid nursery with these other kids, and my parents all dressed up went off for this magical evening of watching a fight and going to have dinner. And I remember just standing at that glass door staring out and going like, God is my witness. I will someday be an adult and live in that world. And so the rest of my life has just been this crazy quest to just do as many sort of cool adult things as I can. That's why I love martinis and I love dressing up and like going to places. Ironically, now to go to Vegas and nobody's dressed up.
But I wondered, when you travel, do you wear a suit on planes?
Yes, always, 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 always. I love those pictures of like the glory days of flight when people were in suits and ties and all that. So I always do. I just try to keep respect for sort of that transportation mode. But I'm literally me and some kind of businessmen who kind of have to dress that way. But here's the thing I found. In general, I've been strip searched more and stopped by security more dressed in a suit than I see guys in sweatpants. Because I think there's something so inherently suspicious about a guy in a suit to airport security that...
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that was before I got TSA, you know, that TSA...
The pre-check?
Pre-check or whatever. But oh, yeah, always get pulled over, like, sir, we need to do an extra search on you. So, you know, I've had to suffer for
your personal
fashion,
art.
Exactly.
And this creating this again, this kind of interesting schism of the British and the Italian, because as you were talking about the Avengers, I just remember the Patrick and these suits weren't cut the way British suits normally cut.
Yeah,
they were much
more fitted.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's like because my Savile Row suits that I do are from Anderson and Shepard, who make like Prince Charles's suits and all that. But I get them to do like a slightly slimmer cut for me.
Is that a tough conversation to have with them?
They're used to it by now.
But they don't like it. I remember going once and to talk about them. The man said, "Oh, clearly you're an American." He actually said it to me.
Oh, really? Yeah, no, they don't hold back. But I mean, I do walk the line because I don't go super slim with it because I do also respect kind of the British look. What I love about what the Italian men's fashion does is everything they wear almost looks like it's slightly too tight, but somehow they pull it off in a way where you go like, that just looks cool. Like the jacket's a little more fitted, the pants are a little sometimes shorter and tighter, but they wear it in this way where they just kind of own it. And I love this fact that I had read somewhere, like a lot of Italian businessmen, when they go into a lunch meeting, they can show up in a tie. When they sit down to start the lunch, they'll take their tie off and just kind of like tuck it in their pocket and do the meeting without the tie on. And then at the end, they'll put the tie back on. And they just say, when I'm doing business, I don't want to be formal or don't want to wear the tie, which I think that's so cool. That's so sprezzatura, because I'm so anal about my tie. Like once I, you know, takes 10 tries to get the knot right, and it's like, okay, don't touch my tie. When I do an interview and they want to put the microphone in my tie knot, it's like, no, don't touch the tie knot.
Well, we certainly have learned a lot about our guest, Paul Feig.
Oh, boy.
Today. The line is J. Crew, which I'm sorry, I'm happy to say, but sorry for myself, it's basically sold out.
Yeah, we've run through it pretty well.
Are there further fashion house collaborations in store for us with you?
I can only dream that there will be. I would love that. I really hope one day to kind of have my own dedicated line. That would be something I would love to work towards.
Would you want to do that?
I would. I mean, I don't understand anything about the business whatsoever, but I just think it'd be fun because I have so many ideas and just philosophies about how to make men look better and more professional and just more together.
And he looks at me as he says, "We're out of time." My guess is
fashion admiringly.
And director Paul Feig. Paul, again, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis. You're always the best.
Recording engineer here at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. My guest, of course, is a man who's so stylish that he's the last white man stopped by TSA as he goes to the airport. The show is
that should be on my tombstone.
Maybe it will. It's mixed by Kat Yor and edited by Blake Pite, associate producer. I'm going to go out and try to get myself some style. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.